Uhuru, you are listening to Diasporic Music on Uhuru Radio. My name is Norman Richmond, and I'm speaking to you from Toronto, Canada. We were listening to the great Dizzy Gillespie playing his song, A Night in Tunisia, along with Charlie Parker. And in December 12, 1963, Kenya became independent. And Dizzy Gillespie was actually invited to the independence celebration, and he went and delivered his speech in Kiswahili. And, you know, Dizzy Gillespie was a Paul Robeson man. He said that he was, he dug Paul Robeson. That was his man. And, you know, the Bandung Conference was a conference that, you know, Paul Robeson, I think he was under indictment, and they had taken his passport. And the Bandung Conference was a conference that brought together the African and Asian countries, many African Asian countries, China, and it was held in Indonesia. And Mr. Robeson could not go. And I have always, when I became politically conscious, I really became a Bandung Conference sort of a guy. And last night I was at an award show, an award gala for a Min Suk Lee. Min Suk Lee is a filmmaker. And they had an award ceremony in her name. She is Korean, and she has did a number of films. And I was talking to her about the unification of Korea, and she did a film called Tiger Spirit, and you can check that out at nfb.ca, I believe. NFB is the National Film Board. And one of the people that was at the dinner was Faith Nolan. And Faith Nolan, of course, has been on Diasporic Music on Uhuru Radio. And she has a new CD out called Jailhouse Blues, Faith Nolan. And, you know, go and try to support her. But anyway, we're going to go back to the unity of people of color, or the Bandung unity, which I've always been since I've been politically conscious, I'm down with the unification of the African people and the Asian people. And my mother used to always tell me that when I was living with her, she told me when Chairman Mao Zedong or Ho Chi Minh was on TV, she didn't know either one of them. She thought they were the same people. And, she would always call me Norman Earl. My birth name is Norman Earl Richmond, and she would say, "Norman Earl, your president is on is on TV." So she knew I was down with the Chinese and down with the Vietnamese. And we're gonna go to this concert in at Massey Hall. I'm living right very close to Massey Hall. I could walk to Massey Hall, but this is Salt Peanuts. And Dizzy Gillespie had Jimmy Carter attempt to sing this particular song when they went to the White House, and Jimmy Carter proclaimed Black Music Month, Black Music Month. He had President Jimmy Carter. He made Jimmy Carter actually sing Salt Peanuts, Salt Peanuts. So this is Salt Peanuts by Dizzy Gillespie, Max Roach, and others.
At this time, we would like to play a tune that was composed by my worthy constituent, Mr. Dizzy Gillespie, in the year 1942. We sincerely hope you do enjoy Salt Peanuts. Thank you.
Salpinas, Salpinas. Salpinas, Salpinas. Salpinas, Salpinas. Salpinas. Salpinas, Salpinas. The name of the song. Salpinas, Salpinas.
Uhuru, you are listening to Diasporic Music on Uhuru Radio, and we were listening to Charlie Parker and Dizzy Gillespie at Massey Hall doing Salt Peanuts, Salt Peanuts, and they had President Jimmy Carter sing that at the White House in 1978-1979. But joining me on the line is Dr. Gerald Horn, who is the author of a brand new spanking book called Black Revolutionary William Patterson and the Globalization of the African American Freedom, and this is a follow-up to his book, Negro Comrades of the Crown, African Americans and the British Empire Fight the U.S. Before Emancipation. And Dr. Horn, how are you doing, my good friend?
Fine, and yourself?
Wonderful. It's been a long time since you and I have conversed.
Sadly enough.
Now, this book, I haven't received a copy of the book, but I know they sent me and said they were going to send me a copy of it, but that's really, there was a book that Mr. Patterson did on himself, and I read that particular book, and I was always impressed by William, because I know he and Paul Robeson and a lot of other respect. Charged the U.S. government with and there was a book called We Charge Genocide, which I have, I purchased that particular book, as well as his biography, but can you talk about a very neglected figure in our history, William Patterson?
William Patterson was a black lawyer, although his roots were in St. Vincent through his father's line and Virginia through his mother's side. He was born in San Francisco approximately 1891 and died in 1980. He became a lawyer attending University of California at Berkeley and was well on his way to being a man of affluence. But his life took a left turn when the Sacco and Vanzetti case arose. Recall, these were the two anarchists of Italian descent who were being tried in 1920s Boston, supposedly for bank robbery and other crimes, and eventually were executed. He got involved in that case and then got involved with some of the comrades in the African Blood Brotherhood, which, as you know, was a sort of a left nationalist formation that had many, quote, West Indians, unquote, in the leadership. And he eventually wound up moving to Moscow in the 1920s as a political operative and a revolutionary. He comes back to the United States in the early 1920s and immediately assumes the leadership campaign. You may recall the Scottsboro case, the case of the nine black youth in northern Alabama who were accused falsely of sexual molestation of two Euro-American women. They're on the verge of execution before the International Labor Defense, of which Patterson was a leader, which was tied to allied organizations across the world, particularly in Moscow, got involved and helped to rescue them from the electric chair and in the process established certain legal precedents with regard to representation of Africans on juries, precedents that are still with us. One of the themes that I sketch in this book and that I've sketched in previous books is that you cannot begin to understand the collapse of slavery and the erosion of Jim Crow without understanding internationalism, without understanding our ability, that is to say, people of African descent, our ability to take our cause to the international arena. During the Scottsboro case, there were demonstrations at U.S. embassies and consulates all over the world, some of which were defaced, some of which were egged, some of which were attacked physically. In any case, after the Scottsboro case, Patterson had something of a physical collapse and wound up going back to the Soviet Union, but he recovered quickly and then assumed a key role in the anti-Nazi underground as the fascists were coming to power in Germany and a good deal of Europe. He managed to escape and move to Chicago, where he was the editor of a paper, the Midwest Daily Record, and was involved in many Communist Party activities. I should have mentioned at this point that Patterson joined the Communist Party of the United States in 1926. From Chicago, he assumed the leadership of the Civil Rights Congress.
And you are listening to Diasporic Music on Uhuru Radio. And I do not know if we have lost Dr. Gerald Horn. I guess we'll go to some music and reconnect with Dr. Gerald Horn. This has been quite a day for the phone. You're listening to Diasporic Music.
At this time, we would like to play a tune that was composed by my worthy constituent, Mr. Dizzy Gillespie, in the year of 1942. We sincerely hope you do enjoy Salt Peanuts.
Salt peanuts. Salt peanuts. The name of the salt. Salt peanuts.
And we are back with Dr. Gerald Horn, and we were talking about Richard Moore joining the Communist Party in not Richard Moore, but he was, he joined the, one of the people that had him, turning him on to the CP was Richard B. Moore, but 1926, that's where we left off.
Well, yes, and also that he was dispatched to New York in 1948 to lead the Civil Rights Congress, which spearheaded the campaign to save Julius and Ethel Rosenberg, the falsely accused atomic spies from Moscow who were executed in 1953, Willie McGee, the black American truck driver in Laurel, Mississippi, who was executed after false accusations of rape, Martinsville 7, similar cases out of Virginia. Cases of political and racist repression were the stock and trade of the Civil Rights Congress. But what happens in the 1950s is that Patterson and Robeson, as you note, filed the petition, the genocide petition of the United Nations, charging the United States with genocide against people of African descent, something that has been talked about quite a bit before and since, but they were the ones who actually did it, as opposed to talk about it. And that led to enormous pressure on Patterson. He was jailed. But this was taking place as there was enormous pressure likewise on the United States to retreat from the more egregious aspects of Jim Crow because of international pressure placed upon the United States by the Soviet Union, rising African liberation movements, for example, in Kenya. And as a result, there were some left-wing leadership like Patterson and Robeson were jailed, had their passports taken, etc. But in return, there were certain anti-Jim Crow concessions made to the mass of black people across the United States, symbolized by Brown versus Board of Education in 1954, supposedly rendering Jim Crow unconstitutional coming in the midst of the Cold War. In some ways, this pulls the rug out from under Patterson, but yet he soldiers on. And, of course, resurfaces to a degree in the 1960s as a counselor to the Black Panther Party and as a lawyer for Angela Davis, two of the leading organizations and individual, of course, in the case of Davis, during that particular time period, before passing away in 1980.
Now, this whole question of the international question, in 1951, we charged genocide. I think we should mention the fact that I think it was David Walker had an appeal, and I think was it 1829. Then we had Martin R. Delaney. He talked about Africa for the Africans. He and I think Robert Campbell went to Nigeria. Then we had Bishop Turner. Then of course we had the Marcus Garvey movement. Would it be fair to say that there is a tradition among African people in the United States and in the Western Hemisphere to realize that international support is needed?
Oh, absolutely. I was just talking about the United Nations specifically, which only came into existence in 1945. And since that time, as you well know, there's been much discussion about going to the UN, but in terms of that genocide petition sold thousands, if not tens of thousands, of copies all over the world. It was used by the Chinese to give to U.S. prisoners of war during the Korean War in the early 1950s. I mean, that was the actual concrete attempt. But as I note in my book that'll be out next in a few months, Slave Resistance and the Origins of the United States of America, you cannot even begin to understand the rocky road from slavery to freedom without understanding our alliances with Spain going back to the 1600s, alliances with London against the settlers here in North America in the late 18th century, alliances with Mexico in the latter part of the 19th century, early part of the 20th century, alliances with Japan in the first few decades of the 20th century, alliances with the Soviet Union. I mean, the list goes on. And I think anybody who does not recognize that fundamental concept might as well be selling card sharks.
Now, you maintain that there was an element of the petty bourgeoisie that sold. We had support. African people had a lot of support from India. You know, when the Indians became independent, they would always talk about the African-American struggle, South African struggle. But once the, in 1954, a certain element of our of black people in America, the petty bourgeoisie basically sold the Indians out because of they don't want to be identified with socialism or communism. Could you elaborate on that?
Well, I take it you're referring to the NAACP. The NAACP purged W.E.B. Du Bois, its founder, in 1948 on the premise and promise that there would be concessions, anti-Jim Crow concessions flowing. And you had Thurgood Marshall, the NAACP leader, who served as an informant for the FBI against Patterson and the Civil Rights Congress. And I guess they felt that that was a good deal at the time. I assume that was their reasoning. But in the long run, all it did was deepen a class rift whereby those who aspired to be Supreme Court justices, in the case of Thurgood Marshall, or perhaps Ivy League professors, were able to do. But for the mass of black people, of course, it meant not doing so well, because going along with that epical turn of events was the decline of unions, decline of working class organizations, decline of many black radical organizations, and there you have it.
Could you talk about, first of all, I'm speaking with Dr. Gerald Horn, author of a brand new book called Black Revolutionary William Patterson and the Globalization of the African-American Freedom Struggle. Could you talk about William Patterson's relationship with Huey P. Newton and the Black Panther Party?
Well, as I said, he was a counselor of sorts to the Black Panther Party. Of course, they were born in the San Francisco Bay Area, where he, in fact, was born. And in the early stages of the party, they were quite close. They worked well together. But eventually, there was a falling out. It may have had something to do with the Panthers and Huey's turn towards Maoist China. And, of course, that was something that Patterson did not support. And they had a very bitter dispute. Ideological dispute, and I think it's quite unfortunate indeed.
The William Patterson's father was from St. Vincent. Did he have did he link himself to the struggle in St. Vincent, or was he basically, well, I guess he was an internationalist, of course, but did he have any, did you find out that he had anything ties to the movement in St. Vincent?
Yeah, he was a man of the cloth. As a matter of fact, a very fervent religious believer. Now, of course, we all know about the St. Vincent struggle in terms of the Caribbean and how, in some ways, it's the most heroic in the Caribbean, perhaps surpassed only by Haiti, perhaps Jamaica. And that's the maelstrom from which Patterson emerged. But his father, to the best I can ascertain, was not part of the movement.
Right. We were supposed to be speaking with Eric Mercury, the electric black man, and I'm mentioning him. I'm only mentioning his roots are St. Vincent. He was born here, but his roots are St. Vincent and Jamaica. Also, I was speaking with a young man by the name of T. N. Providence, who's a great playwright, and he was telling me that St. Vincentians had a lot to do with black theater. They had started a lot of, maybe the first black theater companies in the United States, and I should mention that the person who linked me with you was Samori Moxman, who was born in St. Vincent and the Grenadines. Yes.
Very good, very good. Well, they figured my 1776 book, because part of the thesis is that the Africans in the Caribbean helped to chase the settlers out of the Caribbean, and they basically retrenched to the mainland where they make a stand and ultimately, in many ways, defeat us.
And I heard you on Black Agenda Report speaking with Glenn Ford. Have you done some talks on the book, and you've done so. How much press have you done?
Well, not that much. You know, you write a book praising a black communist in the United States of America, you'd be lucky not to get indicted, I mean, let alone get publicity. But I'm satisfied with the sales. I mean, if you look at, you know, the Amazon list, you'll find that it's doing rather well. It's gotten some good word of mouth and other kinds of reviews.
Yeah, I'm looking at the New York Times review of books, so I guess we are not going to find it in there, of course.
I tend to doubt it, but you never know. You know, I mean, you know. United States is in crisis, U.S. imperialism is in crisis, and when a country is in crisis, things tend to happen that may not have happened when they were not in crisis.
I was talking earlier about the Ban Don conference, and was Mr. Patterson in prison during that particular time? And what was his thoughts on the whole Ban Don conference?
Well, of course, he wrote quite a bit about Ban Don, this conference in Indonesia in the mid-1950s, a conference that featured mostly, although not exclusively, Asian and African nations, and basically was a signal and a harbinger of the development of the non-aligned movement, which comes shortly thereafter. Yes, he was mostly incarcerated during that time, but like most keen observers in the international scene, he was well aware it was a turning point in global history.
And how much do you deal with his relationship with, is it Carlotta Bass? Wasn't she a supporter of the We Charge Genocide? She signed it, or did she have anything to actually... Did she have anything to do with the writing of it, or did she just sign it and support it?
Well, Charlotta Bass of Los Angeles, California, was an editor and publisher of the California Eagle, a progressive black newspaper in Los Angeles. And she and her family had ties before World War I to the Garvey movement. She was a supporter of the left. She ran as vice president on the Progressive Party ticket in 1952. She supported, of course, the genocide petition and publicized the genocide petition. And for that, and among other things, she should be well remembered.
Has there been a biography of her done yet?
There have been a number of articles. I know a person who's been working on a biography for a number of years, but you know how that is. I mean, sometimes people work on biographies all their life and never complete them. So who knows if it'll ever come out.
She is, and also I guess there is another person that we should mention is Claudia Jones was assigned the document. Did she have anything to do with the writing of the document, or did she just sign it?
Well, mostly the latter. Claudia Jones, of course, a native of Trinidad and Tobago, who migrates to New York City, becomes a leader of the Young Communist League and the Communist Party, and a intellectual. There have been a number of books about Claudia Jones, the most latest by Carol Boyce Davies of Cornell University. Claudia Jones is deported from the United States after serving jail term and pitches up in London, where she becomes a leader of that black community, helps to found a newspaper in London, the West Indian Gazette, helps to found the Carnival in London, in Notting Hill, and is a woman who is well remembered in at least three different countries, Trinidad, United States, and Great Britain.
And we're winding down now, but I think a lot of people do not realize the fact that Malcolm X, the whole question of El Hajj Malik El Shabazz taking the plight of the Africans in America to the United Nations was really inspired by the CP, because I think Durham, the guy who wrote Muhammad Ali's one of his biographies, his first biographies. I think he was either in the CP or close to the CP, and then the whole idea basically was the We Charge Genocide thing was inspired Malcolm's whole question of trying to take the United Nations, take the U.S., take our plight, our African people's plight, to the UN. Am I correct in saying that?
Oh, sure. I mean, it's amazing if you look at some of the Communist Party positions. They're still with us, albeit under different organizational form. I mean, the whole question of the Negro nation, self-determination, and the Black Belt. I mean, in many ways, that comes straight out of the Communist Party playbook from the 1930s. And that, of course, is a position that's still with us with regard to various organizations.
But the whole question of self-determination, I think we've talked about this before. I think that before the CP, you know, took that position, I think there were Africans in the United States that held that same position of having their own self-determination, be it in the United States, be it in Haiti or Africa. Not to put that position down, but I'm just saying I don't think that some people argue that black people in America, had to look to Moscow in order to take self-determination position, which I think is not a correct position, because I think Africans everywhere talked about self-determination, no matter where they were. And I think there's an article with a debate between discussion between C.L.R. James and Leon Trotsky, and Trotsky is asking C.L.R. James, if black people in America weren't for self-determination, why was this guy by the name of Marcus Garvey so popular?
Well, as I write in my 1776 book, which will be out in a few months, it's not only that you just sketched. There was a battle for North America, and the Africans in North America before 1776 were seeking to control North America in league with indigenous people and with foreign patrons to confront the settler class. The Africans basically lost, and therefore slavery and enslavement was accelerated and indeed was expanded by the settlers, who of course went on to lead the bringing of Africans to Cuba and to Brazil, which of course has the largest population of African descent in the Americas. The point that I was making is that with regard to concretizing and actualizing and moving forward in the 20th century, in particular with regard to self-determination, there were few organizations that excelled or exceeded the Communist Party at that particular moment. I mean, like I said, there's Mr. Do and there's Mr. Say. And with regard to Mr. Do, the communists have been much more in the vanguard than, say, Mr. Say.
Even more so than in the Garvey movement, you say? But we definitely run out of time, because we'd definitely have to continue. Well, if this discussion is going to be continue, I guess, when you're out on the road, definitely taking this book out.
Absolutely.
All right, sir. So I really appreciate your time, and sorry about the technical problems, but people can listen to this interview, I guess, in about a half an hour. It would be up on the archives, and I'll be sending it out, and other people will be sending it out. So thank you very much.
Oh, fantastic. Thank you, sir. Good luck. Bye-bye.
All right. And I would like to thank Lisa Watson for handling the technical aspects of the show today. I would like to thank Munyon Sui Kamalingua. I would like to thank Dr. Gerald Horn. And I'd like all of us to remember Dizzy Gillespie, Maxwell Roach, Charles Parker, Charles Mingus, and Bud Powell, and that great concert that took place at Massey Hall here in Toronto. And Massey Hall also was the first place that Bob Marley performed in 1976 or 77 here in Toronto, was at Massey Hall. This is Norman Otis Richmond saying we will see you in the whirlwind.